We're looking again in James, the fourth chapter from verse 13, and reading into the fifth chapter to the sixth verse. And very much the matters which James is about there are matters to do with life and living, which could apply as much to his day as to ours, what we need to know if we are to make our way correctly and rightly, with a right attitude towards the work that we have and the world that we live in. For he, again, in his usual stark way, gives to us indications about the pitfalls that there are and of the headstrong ways that can so quickly engulf Christians and lead them off into wrong ways of thinking about the world that they live in and the lives that they have. It's very easy for us to be deceived into thinking that the life that we have just rolls on day by day. We are not in a country that is afflicted by war. We're not in a country that has experienced great famine in recent history. For the most part, things run pretty smoothly. Despite, hospital waiting lists, we wouldn't underestimate those, or trains that run late, but my word, having been to India, I can say that we're doing pretty well here by comparison. So there are lots of things that there is the danger we will take for granted. We live without the anarchy that so many countries have. We don't have the same amount of terrorism that some places in the world experience in their day-to-day living. We have many things that we should be very thankful for and should never err into any kind of complacency in believing that we have some divine right to these things and some innate hold upon these matters, that they must remain ever thus and never ever be changed. At times, we know what it is to have a rude awakening, when there is the foot and mouth disease, when there are petrol crises, when there are accidents. Suddenly we can be jolted from our complacency and begin to look upon this world or our country not as being a sort of benign place that just constantly will be there to provide for our wants and our needs. Suddenly we see that things can and do go wrong, even in our own society. And James is very mindful of this, and is very concerned that as Christians we should live our lives very carefully in this world. And those passages in James 4, verse 13, and into chapter 5, and verse 6, are a warning to us. Life, you see, is not a permanent state of affairs. Neither you nor I know what tomorrow will hold. Any one of us can think back to how our lives perhaps were revolutionized, whether for the good or for the ill, by an event, some happening, something that caught us unawares, and the whole trajectory of our life, the whole way in which we conceived of our future, was completely altered. Of course, our conversion would be one of the biggest events in that category. We might have had ideas about the kind of life we were going to live, what we were going to do, and then we were converted. And all those plans went by the by. And we then entered in perhaps a whole new career, or a whole new different way. But equally, there are other events. Events that come to us and strike us, which remind us that we are not here forever. And that we cannot think that everything will just continue as it always has. We'll just go about our day-to-day work. If it's Monday, we do this. If it's Tuesday, we do that. If it's Wednesday, we're off there. Thursday, we stay at home. Or whatever the routine of our week might be. Many times, the Bible warns us that we are but here for a season. Psalm 39 and verses 4 to 6, the psalmist asks there that he might understand these things. Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly, every man at his best state is but vapor. Surely, every man walks about like a shadow. Surely, they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them. And again, in other places in the Psalms, the psalmist reflects upon how life is one moment here and the next moment gone. Psalm 62, verse 9. Surely men of low degree are a vapor. Men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. And one further instance of this kind of thinking that is such a corrective to any idea that we're just going to go on and go on and nothing will ever change or go wrong in our lives. Psalm 144, verses 3 to 4. Lord, what is man that you take knowledge of him, or the son of man that you are mindful of him? Man is like a breath, his days are like a passing shadow. That's how it is. And however long we might live, by God's grace, however many years he might have allotted to us, we are but a vapor, but a breath, and we are gone. We are not here permanently. And James reminds us that we must always live with that somewhere in our thinking. We are not in control of everything, and he is very concerned against the kind of boastful arrogance that is so abroad in our society. Go to other places and other walks of life, and it's all the plans that are being made and all that's going to happen. I used, when I was in London, to come back on the train sometimes of an evening if I'd been at a conference or meeting, and you'd just hear the young men fresh from their office work, or perhaps having made a trip via the local hostelry or something, and full of themselves and what's going on and what they're going to do, where the big selling markets are and the buying markets, what commodities are really on the up and where you don't want to be because it's going to crash. It really was such a whole life that they were wrapped up in. And there they were going back for their weekends, and I dare say Monday morning they'd talk about what they'd done over the weekend and roll up their sleeves ready for another week of the same. More trading, more everything else. Well, we know that economies do crash. Stock markets do rise and do fall. The value of your investments, the advertisement tells us, doesn't it, may fall as well as rise, or words to that effect. And so we are to remember that. There James saw a church where, sadly, there was oppression. The rich, who thought themselves impregnable and had failed even to pay their labourers their wages, in verse 4. And he says that these things are crying out to the Lord of Sabaoth, people that lived on earth in pleasure and luxury. And he says in verse 5 of chapter 5, you've fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. But James found great problems in the churches that he was addressing, and he saw that there were very carnal attitudes that were abroad, and we've already encountered some of these, with greater prominence given to those who were rich. And it would seem that the rich themselves had felt themselves almost immune from prosecution, didn't even bother paying their labourers. And James instructs them to weep and to howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. We have to remember that we live in a world where we are tenants and where our Creator is the one who is in charge. That he gives us the years that we live, he gives us the riches or the poverty that we have, and we have to live in such a way as to accommodate to whatever he provides for us. The world is his handiwork, not ours. He has established it, founded it, founded the earth upon the waters, established and fixed the boundaries for the nations of the earth. The opening words of the Bible tell us this and bring us always short if ever we're to get puffed up in our own thinking and our own creativity and what we're doing. Well, were we there in the beginning? No. But the Bible tells us who was in the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. And so it proceeds from there. All comes from God. He is the one that speaks, and it is so. And there is no argument, no creature is there to rise up and say, why are you doing it this way? Why are you proceeding in this manner? It is his province, it is his power, and it is his concern. The world has its structure, the world has its order because of him. Notwithstanding the fall, which has brought such confusion and hardship upon us, which has made the earth to produce its thorns and its thistles, still it has structure and order. You see the farmers with their tractors toing and froing through the marketplace, going from here to there, and presumably the things that they're carrying will help the ground grow better, produce the harvests, produce the crops. They know a thing or two. They know what will work, and it will work because God has so ordained it. God has bestowed the properties that things possess. And it is there for man to think God's thoughts after him and to be able to work with the light that he gives to achieve the productivity that the land has. As if it was ourselves. As if we were thinking we shall go to such and such a city. We shall there earn ourselves a great huge fortune. Ah, the structure, the order, the opportunities to make riches. All of these things come from this world that God has created. All of these things. Nothing of ourselves. And as with creation, so it is with God in his providential works. God's government day by day. God's government moment by moment. The outcomes of life. Providential arrangements known only to God. God, whose infinite wisdom overrules, constructs together according to wisdom this world. All of the myriad activities, all of the happenings here and there. What small cogs we are in this vast, complex machinery of the world. How small is our understanding compared to the vastness of God's intelligence and of his holding together in one the past, the present, and the future, knowing how it is all going to work out, knowing where you and I and everybody else will be, or ever has been, or any in the future that are to be born, their exact birthplaces, how long they'll live, and what they will do. What great works! And Job was able to reflect upon his glory, and even in the times of his great hardship there, reflect upon that it is God who does all things ultimately. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So in providence, as he saw withdrawn from him his family, his means of employment, his crops, all his possessions, in those moments when the devil was given access to him and permitted to take away those things from him, still that was his testimony. He knew about the providence of God. He knew that it was all if the Lord wills. And if the Lord does not will, then all of the plans and intentions of the heart will come to nothing. So we see then, providence. We must learn to see everything that God has gifted us with as being indeed a gift from God. Not of our own construction, not of something that we dreamt up. That which God endowed us with from birth is not of our own great intelligence, not something that we can congratulate ourselves over. It was the fault of the Corinthian church to think in rather carnal and in rather godless ways about themselves. 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 7, Paul reminds them this, "For who makes you differ from another? And what do you have that you did not receive? Now if you did indeed receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? Why do you speak as though this was something that was due to you and your innate intelligence? Why could you not humble yourselves and see that it came from God?" So the lesson is, everything. Everything in this world in which God is creator, everything in this world in which God is the governor and the providential arranger of all things, everything is if the Lord wills. verse 15 of that fourth chapter. Instead of all of this great planning, there are these business people, let's go to such and such a city, they say, spend a year there, buy and sell, make a profit. Whereas, says James, you don't know what tomorrow will bring. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. If he wills. And therein is not a cliche or some sort of formula that we should always tack on to the end of a sentence. Here is an attitude that should be perpetually with us. We should continually regard ourselves and our life and our future with that idea that if the Lord wills. Now, it's not to say we shouldn't make plans. We should make many plans. It's not as if we should be aimless, not really have a strategy about where we're going or how we're going to get there. Indeed, we should. Paul himself was a great planner. He knew where he was intending to go, which countries he was going to visit. And if God showed him otherwise, then he redirected according to what God had shown. But it's still, he did what was within his power to do and used his mind to plan ahead. Nothing wrong in that. So we should. We should budget. We should ensure that we have the wherewithal to sustain ourselves on into the future and be wise as stewards in those things. Yet, for all of the good planning and all of the wisdom that we might apply, and indeed for all of the prayer that we might raise up to God as we look ahead and as we seek to bring down, as it were, from heaven his blessing upon us, still our prayers must be marked by that same attitude, if the Lord wills. I mean, we trust ahead of us this year, as much of it as remains. Many things that we look forward to, exhibitions, people ask me what's happening, Bible exhibitions coming up and opportunities around and about us there. Things like this, day conferences, we've got them in our diaries, we remind ourselves of them, we pray for them, and so we should. Of course, every single one of those is but if the Lord wills. And we must approach it in that way. We must have such a hold upon it that if we find that it's taken from our grasp, we're able, with Job, to say, if the Lord wills, able to resign ourselves, able to submit ourselves to his superior wisdom, if the Lord wills. And so we learn from this, that each day we should live it in a constant sense of thanksgiving. For unless the Lord willed, we would have had nothing. Unless the Lord had willed it so, we would have enjoyed nothing of that day, nor received anything in that day, nor been capable of rendering any useful service in that day. We are to be a constantly thankful people. And we were learning in that passage that we read there in Philippians and in chapter 4, that necessity of being a thankful people, rejoicing in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Being anxious in verse 6 for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, letting our requests be known to God. Time and time and time again, we're instructed to be a people who are a thankful people. We remember where these blessings come from and are quick to return thanks to the one that provided them. We're not saying, well, we'll go here and do this, and that's our ingenuity and our own power and strength, we'll do it. No, we live in conscious dependence upon God. We know that he is the author of these things, the opportunities, the times, the seasons, the days we live in. And therefore, in all of our life, it is a life marked by thanksgiving, a life marked by conscious dependence upon God. For us, it is as if it is a harvest festival every day. Every day is a day in which we remember what God has done for us and reflect upon the fact that if he withdraws his blessing, if his will is for something else, then all that we have and all that we are about collapses like that, and we, like that vapor, are gone. Thanksgiving, God is always pleased with. And 1 Thessalonians and chapter 5 is another a reminder to us there of the necessity of this in the life of the believer. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. In everything, in all things. Paul himself, going back to Philippians chapter 4, looked back on his life, knew there were times when he had had plenty and times when he had been in want. I know, he says in verse 12, how to be abased, and I know how to abound everywhere. And in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He's a man that knew that if he had plenty, then it was God's will for him for that season, but it could all change. And that if he suddenly found himself in dire circumstances and straitened, this again was God's will for him, and that he would find God's grace and God's strength in it if he met those days not with a sense of injustice and outrage, but of thanksgiving. God had provided what he had for that day, whether it was plenty or whether it was little. God had been the one that was the author of those things. And so we, not like these proud businessmen, boasting about what they're going to do here and there, how much money they're going to make, we need to be much more humble than that. We need to be a people that are thankful. We also need, of course, to be prayerful. A prayerful people. Everything that we are about should be bathed in prayer. That is what is completely absent in verse 13 from these people who are just going off and doing what they want. They haven't prayed about it, haven't thought about it, hasn't even registered with them that maybe they ought to seek divine permission before they enter into their schemes, or seek divine blessing upon it if they're ever to see any progress in their work. No, they believe it's their own strength that will do this. And so how wrong they are. And we have to learn, if the Lord wills, and therefore be a people of prayer. Big decisions require much prayer. We're moving. Some change, career change, change in direction, some new thing that we're embarking upon. It is for us to pray, and indeed more than pray, to fast too, that God may reveal, that God may direct, that we may know if it is his will in the first place, and therefore enter into this in a humble and in a dependent state, rather than in a sense of our own hubris and a sense of our own possessions and our own powers. All future planning requires prayer. To pray for the things that lie ahead of us this year that I've mentioned. Do ask God and entreat God, because they're only if he wills. And we must always come to him, making it very clear that we don't think that we have any right to these things, or that he has no right to change our plans if he should so choose. Be prayerful, because prayer, again, like thanksgiving, is an expression of our dependence upon God. It is a showing forth to our own soul, but also to heaven, that we are not doing this lightly, that we are not thinking that it lies within our power, but are completely dependent upon God, ultimately for every breath that we draw. So, plans require prayer. And we have to remember that we are those tenants, and but tenants at the end. That we have no rights that we can assert. God does not owe us a living. God does not owe us some happiness or joy upon earth. God calls us to serve him. And the joy and the happiness that will flow from that indeed will be a recompense, but is not the first thing that we have in our minds. We are not amongst those who can insist and assert their rights and feel that God must do something because they've shouted long enough or because they feel that these things they must have. We should never moan at God's providence. Never be tempted to argue with his arrangements for our lives. Oh, so often. It's completely the other way, isn't it? Then that we moan and we groan. We feel things haven't worked out. We feel aggrieved at things. We feel cheated of things. We feel we've been robbed of our rights. And we have to learn to bury those feelings and those thoughts. We have to learn that the world that surrounds us is God's world. He does with us as he sees fit. And it's not for us to rise up and to argue with him and to moan and to say that he is unjust, because the God of all this world is just. He is the judge of the earth. How could he be unjust? And it is therefore for us to bridle ourselves. We have to learn to bring down our own lofty thoughts, our own feelings in this matter, and to resign ourselves, to be peaceful, to be submissive. It's that same wisdom again that James was speaking about that comes from above. That pure, that peaceable, that gentle wisdom. That wisdom that's willing to yield, willing to part with its so-called rights. That peaceable wisdom full of mercy and good fruits. That's the kind of attitude that we need to cultivate, to be humble, to accept God's will for our lives, which is an experience and a learning process that takes a lifetime of discipleship. For God's will sometimes is very hard to discern. It's true, it's difficult sometimes to understand precisely why we might be going through a particular trial, why something that we attempted and had prayed for didn't quite work. Why it didn't yield what we had hoped for it? Why when we went to a certain city or went to a certain place, expected indeed, as we felt we'd prayed that it would open up to us, that somehow it didn't. And all the disappointment that we carried away from that, and all the questions perhaps in our hearts that rose up in that. We must learn to be humble, to accept God's will, to believe that while we could almost calculate what we think we have lost in that process, what we feel didn't work out, and we can almost say, well, if it had worked out, I would now be able to do this, and indeed things for the Lord I'd be able to do. I'd be able to be here, and I'd be able to have done this, but it hasn't happened at all. The soul searching and the questioning and the murmuring that goes on. We must accept sometimes there is mystery in God's providential arrangements, in his will, his secret will. He has not disclosed everything to us. And we have to learn, all learn, to submit ourselves, to resign ourselves, to be humble and submissive to him. We are always to believe in the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God. Now some Christians think, oh, this is a doctrine, it's difficult. But in fact it is of immense comfort. That in all of the providential arrangements that sometimes make for such difficulty for ourselves, he is sovereign and king over all. There is a purpose. You may not see it, may not understand it. You may not be able to say, well, it is the Lord's will, though. I don't understand exactly how it is, but he does. Because he is the king and the sovereign over all. That accident that I had, that trouble that came across my family, that illness that struck me down, that time when I seemed depressed and low and couldn't get out of it, and time just seemed to be wasted so much, and I did everything I thought was right to do and within my power to do, and still it didn't yield. That job I prayed about and I went to, and it all collapsed, and it was calamitous, and we lost money and the rest. But still God was sovereign, and is still sovereign. And will still be sovereign. So when we go forth this year, and perhaps certain things won't quite work, or certain personal plans that we have don't quite come to fruition, don't despair. Don't be overly discouraged. Don't think that the whole world has ended because of that, though it may feel it at the time. God is still sovereign. And it is still his will that is prevailing. And even though at times, as parents, we have to take away from our children the things that they enjoy, but they can't see the long term, that those things aren't necessarily the best for them. So God sometimes has to take from us things that are painful for us to be parted with. For he has a wider purpose and a wiser purpose. He has a sovereign purpose as the King of Kings. And he will carry that forth, though we cannot always understand the way of it. So finally, have faith. Have faith. Believe and trust. So that when something perhaps has not worked out, stay still, it is God's will. And as you look forward to the future, stay still, God does have a will. God does have a plan. And though I cannot see it all now, I believe he is sovereign, and I believe that he will do what is right. What an antidote to the boasting. What an antidote to this evil talk that James was here having to correct amongst the churches, this self-centered, man-centered business, which had led, as we see in chapter 5, even to them withholding the wages from these labourers. No, if they'd been people who were humble, lived in dependence, conscious dependence upon God, they'd have seen that their riches were not theirs to have and to hold, that they should be liberal and should give and should be free with them in that respect, but should also live in a way that is pleasing to God, that real prayerful humility and dependence, the heart that says, if the Lord wills, says it not fatalistically, but by faith believing that there is a sovereign God who is directing and orchestrating the lives of us all, and whose will is best, whose desires toward us are only desires of love, and who will prevail to the benefit of a kingdom, to our own personal benefit, our own involvement will become clear to us in the light of eternity, so that perhaps while a venture in one city or another didn't quite work, we didn't stay there a year, the whole thing collapsed, we didn't manage to buy, we didn't manage to sell, and we certainly made no profit, that while we may have many of those things behind us, God is still sovereign, and we can say, by faith, if the Lord wills, believing and trusting that he really does know best.